We're still talking about freedom, part two, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is my co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principle Policy, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Great to be back with you, Barry. A beautiful day today and glad to be sitting back on the back porch studios watching the birdies fly as we record another hopefully good program.
Well, we believe they're all good.
Now,
they may not sound the greatest in the world, but we believe that the content's pretty solid.
We'll see what the radio listeners and the podcast listeners think. That's up to them.
That's fine. Well, you know what? We started talking about freedom and liberties, and last week we talked about religious liberties. Today we're going to talk about, and that's individual, Chuck. That's kind of that self-government idea, okay? Now we're going to talk about local government, and I mean local as opposed to federal, specifically, and then we're going to talk a little bit about federal, too. But you and I were kind of impressed by something we saw popping up in the media here in the just recent past, an idea whose time has been hinted at, sometimes threatened, but looks like is actually coming. And I think that when it does come, Charles, if it does, because there's still an awful lot of standing on the brink that might be happening around this, that when that time does come, I do believe that you will start seeing a wave of the same type of event start to happen. Now, before we talk about what that event is, what we really want to make sure that people are aware of are a couple things. And it's shameless plug time. we're going to be starting soon a new Institute on the Constitution course in Marietta, Ohio. I've been going down and meeting with the folks down there who are interested in putting one on. I've actually been giving them kind of a mini class to kind of help break them into what we really teach when we teach Institute on the Constitution. And part of what we teach is what we're going to be talking about today. And so if you know folks who are down along the Washington County, Ohio River, Marietta, you know, that whole general part of the state, who are interested in learning about how to use the Constitution as the tool that our founders intended it to be used for, drop us a line, send us an email, and let us know, and we will add you to the list for the announcements. Now, the announcements are not out yet, so you can't go on our website just yet, because we're still trying to put together location, dates, and times for this class. But I've been contacted by the leadership down there in the Marietta groups that really want to have us come down and talk Constitution. We also, I know it's early, but we've also been offered a chance to come and teach another class again in Sunbury, Ohio, and we'll be looking at that toward the fall. I think there are a couple of other areas that we're looking at. And if you've got a group in your area of at least 12 people who you can put together who'd be willing to take a course on the U.S. Constitution and its history, our biblical foundations, the philosophies and beliefs of our founders, how the document was put together and why it was put together the way it was, and how it still serves as an operational guidebook for the running of our government, or should, contact us. Let us know. You know, we come by invitation. We don't go out and do big marketing blitzes to groups and, you know, mailing lists, you know, and giving them, you know, discount specials and one-time only deals and all that other fun stuff that you see in all the mass marketing that goes on. We just, when people get word of what's going on, and we have usually it's alumni from our classes who start talking to other people, and then we get a group together and we teach our Institute on the Constitution course. It's a 12-week course, 2 hours a night, once a week for 12 weeks. We usually try to do them in the spring and in the fall, because summertime, both Charles and I are very much consumed by things that we're working on, including Camp American. And that's the other shameless plug that I wanted to make sure we talked about today.
It is June 14th through the 20th. Angola, Indiana. Oh, where's that? Northeast corner of Indiana. Sounds like it's really far away. From Columbus, it's about a three-hour drive, three and a half hours at most. Well worth the drive, folks. Kids 12 and up, and also adults can sign up as campers. And believe me, there is stuff there for everyone. Everybody says, well, why would I want to go to a kids' camp? Well, I would suggest you go out to YouTube and look at some of the classes that we've taught, because I've got a few samples out there. You've got 10-minute samples up, so you can see what's up. Guess what? It's geared to adults, too. There's a lot of you that can learn a lot of stuff at Camp American, and we could use you as a volunteer. If you come as camper, you got to pay. If you come as a volunteer, guess what? Freebie. You're a camp volunteer. You get to come sit in the classes for free. So come on up. Barry Sheets and I are both teaching classes this year. We've got Joel McDermott from American Vision talking on his book, God versus Socialism. We've got Mike Kaufman from Environmental Perspectives Incorporated coming up to talk about global warming and the whole climate change thing and how it's being used. We've got Dave Whitney from Institute on the Constitution coming. So please come on up to Camp America and join us. We'd love to have you. Volunteer, send your kids, grandkids, nieces and nephews, neighbors' kids, whatever. Come on up.
Yeah, and we would strongly encourage you to come and do that. I think it's a fantastic opportunity, and we know that the kids enjoy it because they form their own Facebook fan pages, usually counting down days until camp the next year. So we're pretty happy with that. And so we hope you would be too. So join us. Go over to campamerican.com and look at what we're doing and sign your kids or your grandkids or yourself up and come on up. So, but Chuck, we're going to talk a little bit about the Constitution and the way it's really being used. And we're going to look at something that, again, like I said earlier, if this actually goes through, if the brinksmanship moves toward actual implementation, it's a significant shift of power and ultimately will trigger a constitutional challenge or maybe a constitutional crisis even. But it might actually get some other entities saying, maybe we should be doing this too.
Well, it will trigger a constitutional crisis, and honestly, that's a good thing because we have a lot of people that are in panic mode right now. And honestly, when you're in panic mode, you need to stop and think through issues rather than knee jerking into things.
Yeah, I think we may have talked about that a little bit in our last week's program about RFRA and the quick fix that they tried to do inside of a week that really didn't.
Yeah, quick fix that basically created a bigger mess than they would have had they just let it be the way it was.
Right.
But that being said, there are things that can be done, and this will, like I said, from the commentary on the article that we're going to be reading from, and which I am one of the commentators, you're going to find that this is definitely an issue that is a hot button topic, and people see all kinds of good and bad and horrible things in it, and there's all kinds of misconceptions about what the Constitution actually says about this issue. So we'll be talking about that as well in today's show.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we're talking about, folks, is a piece of legislation that has been passed by the Alaska House of Representatives. Now, this happened the first week of April, or right after Easter, so the day after Easter. The Alaska House of Representatives voted and moved a bill that would order the federal government to hand over most federal land situated in the state of Alaska to the state of Alaska by no later than December 31st of next year, of 2016. I'm going to let that sink in for
That's
a second.
Right. We need to let that sink in a little bit. In other words, Alaska's taking back the land within its state boundaries from the federal government.
That's right. Now, the sponsor of this bill is no rookie green Tea Party radical freshman legislator. It's House Speaker Mike Cheneaux, the Speaker of the Alaska House of Representatives. This is his bill. He has looked at this, and he has said clearly that the way he sees it, the federal government, first and foremost, is in breach of contract. And what he means is the 1958 Alaska Statehood Act. When Alaska was recognized as a state, there was a provision in that act that basically says that the federal government promised to hand over to Alaska, I forget how many hundreds of millions of acres.
It's 116 million acres.
Yeah, 116. I forget how many.
Further down in the article, if you go down there, it talks about how big an area that is. 116 million acres is something like the states of Montana and Wyoming together.
Yeah, okay. And basically what he's saying is they've defaulted because there's about 5 million acres that they have yet to hand over. Now, Chuck, you think 1958, you're looking at 57 years, it'll be 58 in 2016, of not completing the contract that they agreed to. And I think just from contract theory, that's probably, they've probably got a fairly good standing on that in that respect. They've had an even better standing in a couple of other respects. Now, I want to, before we talk about the other respects, this bill is not without its amount of controversy within the state of Alaska.
You don't say.
I don't say. No, I do say. Well, I don't say. A lot of other people say in Alaska.
Yeah.
Now, this is coming from Alaska Dispatch News, ADN.com. And basically where it says Alaska House brushes off constitutional claims, orders massive federal land transfer by Dermot Cole. Well, what he's talking about this constitutional claims is that there are some people in the Alaska legislature and around the Alaska legislature who are screaming that this is 100% unconstitutional. In other words, you don't have any constitutional authority to pass this bill. Now, Charles, we love these
claims. I really do love these kinds of claims.
We love these claims. This is, that particular claim is coming from Anchorage Democrat Rep. Les Gara and was echoed by another Democrat rep, Andy Josephson, who said he would, quote, be violating his oath of office if he backed the bill. Now, Charles, when you're going to double down, make sure you don't double down on a pair of twos.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, it's interesting. When I commented on this article, and we'll post the link, not to my comment. You can dig around and find it if you really want to, but you can dig around on the article. I basically called that into question. The first thing I said was, okay, you guys who are saying it's a waste of time and effort to pass this bill, it's a waste of money, it's a sure loser, blah, 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 blah. I said, you need to take a minute or two and actually read the Constitution on this issue.
Now, that's where I would say you don't double down on twos, and you also don't go all in on twos. But Josephson couldn't help himself. He put the whole pot in the kitty where he said, quote, the Constitution says it's illegal. The Supreme Court, meaning the U.S. Supreme Court, reading the Constitution, since when?
Yeah.
Says it's illegal. The lawyers we pay in the Terry Miller building say it's illegal.
That's their state, office building.
Yeah, their state office building. And our past attorney general says it's illegal. So there's not much left here. Well, you're right, Josephson. There's not much left here because you have basically thrown out and laid on the table all of your twos and off cards that you have in your hand.
That's it.
Problem is, you're playing against a royal straight flush in the Constitution because the Constitution does not say it's illegal. As a matter of fact, Charles, the Alaska Speaker of the House, Mike Cheneaux, actually knows this and knows the Constitution better than Democratic Rep. Andy Josephson, better than the Supreme Court, better than the lawyers they pay in the Terry Miller building, and better than their past attorney general.
That's right.
And I'm gonna open it up here for you to just wax eloquent on what the Constitution actually does say about this issue of federal lands.
Thank you very much. This is Article 1, Section 8. Article 1, Section 8 is probably the most important section of the Constitution. If you don't know why, then you don't understand how the Constitution works, because what this is a section called the Enumerated Powers. The federal government, specifically in Article 1, the Congress, only has a limited number of actual powers that have been surrendered by the states and the people to the federal government. And Article 1, Section 8 lays out what Congress's powers, rights, and responsibilities are. Now, this is, I believe, Clause 17. It doesn't matter which clause it is, because you can find it. It's near the end of Article 1, Section 8. Here's what it says. The Congress shall have the power to, quote, exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square. What is 10 miles square?
What? 100 square miles.
That's right. And where is it? Where is that district?
I think that's in where they call Columbia.
That's right. That's the District of Columbia. So, well, that's out of the way. As may, by session of particular states. What's a session? Barry, what's a session of a particular state?
The session of a particular section of a particular state?
Session. C-E-S-S-I-O-N.
That means the state actually willingly and voluntarily giving it up.
That's right.
In other words, it's a constituent act, Charles. It's not they didn't say anything, so we just assumed that we could take it.
That's right. They can't seize it. It has to be ceded.
Yes.
By the permission of the state legislature. Okay. May, by session of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of government of the United States, and to exercise like authority, in other words, using the same mechanism, to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings.
Okay. Forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards. Keep that in mind. Forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards.
And needful buildings.
Needful buildings. Now, we know what some of those needful buildings are, Charles, because they're also spelled out in Article 1, Section 8.
That's right.
Because Congress can pass laws to establish those needful buildings. What are those needful buildings in Article 1, Section 8? Post offices.
Post offices, yeah. Needful buildings, post offices. Okay, so what this actually says is that Congress may own land inside of a state as long as the state legislature gives them permission to do so, and as long as Congress says, okay, we'll take that particular piece of land. What does that say about the idea, especially when the federal government contracted to give land back? And we'll talk about why this is a major problem. First of all, that the federal government owns land at all.
Mm-hmm.
But what does this say about the idea that it's unconstitutional to take land that actually belongs to the state by contract? I see the torpedo has hit that boat amidships, and it's taking on water and going down fast.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going anyplace. It's dead in the water. One more torpedo hit and it'll go. Now, what's the problem with the idea that the federal government, and as we know, there is a, I'm going to give the, another plug to Camp American. There is a video available given by Pastor David Whitney of Institute on the Constitution called The Federal Land Grab, and he talks about a lot of these issues.
Yes, he does.
Right now, the federal government owns more than 50% of the land west of the Mississippi. It owns something like 96% of the land in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
What's wrong with this picture? Why does the federal government own land at all? Well, what has happened in the past is that as a requirement for statehood,
yes,
states have been required to allow the federal government, and the constitutionality of this requirement is extremely questionable. In other words, it's blackmail. Either you allow us to own land here or you won't get your statehood, to allow the federal government to own land within the boundaries of the state. Now, does the federal government ever actually own land? Let's talk about the idea of federal territories.
Okay, very good.
Does the federal government actually own that land?
No, they don't.
They do not. What do they do? They're
leaseholders.
They're essentially, they're holding it in trust.
Right. Think the Panama Canal Zone.
Exactly. They hold it in trust for the 50 states because, as we know from the Constitution, the federal government is a creation of the states. Who really owns that territory?
The states do.
The 50 states own it. Right. The federal government holds it in trust until such time as another state is set up within the boundaries of that federal land.
Yes.
Where does the federal land then go automatically?
It goes to, it's ceded to the state.
It has to be ceded to the state, which is created out of that land.
As part of the land appropriation for the state.
As part of the idea of that the land is owned in trust.
Right.
When you hear about paying off the federal debt in the 19th century by selling federal land, what were they doing? They were selling land that was held in trust for the states to pay off indebtedness. Not only that, but to get enough people in a territory so that a new state could be formed.
Exactly.
Now, what's the idea? All of a sudden, somebody comes up with a great idea. Well, the federal government needs to put in the what's called the Enabling Act. And that's what this article's talking about, this contract agreement, is the Enabling Act of the state, Alaska, to come into the union. And there was a big controversy at the time. There were a lot of people that did not want to become a state precisely because all this land would go into federal trust.
Right.
Because there's a grave misunderstanding that the federal government owns the land. They don't, because they're not a separate entity. They're an agent of the states. Okay. That being the case.
Bet that's a new one on a lot of people.
That's a brand new one on a lot of people. But what that does is it puts the states and the state, particular state, in the driver's seat regarding how the property is to be disposed of.
Absolutely.
Now, let me ask you a question. Here's a little trivia question, and you remember Camp American. This came up last year.
Okay.
Dave Whitney did an updated version of that federal land grab thing. Do you remember what the first state was that had in its Enabling Act the requirement that the federal government be allowed to own property inside its boundaries?
Was it Maryland?
No.
No. Which one was it? Ohio.
Ohio was
That's
the first
right.
one. Very good. You get the prize, man. Ohio was the first state. And what year was it?
Well, we became a state in 1803.
1803, the Enabling Act that allowed Ohio to become a state was the first state that the federal government demanded to be allowed to own land inside the state.
Which is interesting, Charles, because if you know the history of Ohio, you know that before Ohio became a state, we were part of a landmass known as the Northwest Territory.
Yep.
And that when the decision was made and we reached those constitutional parameters for statehood, what they did was they platted it out. They surveyed the entire territory. And today, you can go down to the Ohio State House, into the State House, not to the Historical Society, and in the halls, down in the basement area, as you're going between the Senate building and the State House, you have all these displays from the Historical Society. One of the displays is a copy of a page from the Seven Ranges survey. It shows the platting of every township, 36-square-mile township. There were specific plots that were set aside for education. There were specific plots set aside for arsenals. Remember, armaments for the federal government. And there were also plots set aside for ministerial lands.
That's right.
There was no plot set aside that said this will be a federal national park.
Or whatever they were using it for. In some cases, it was Indian reservations, which is an entirely different set of circumstances.
But the Seven Ranges Survey, the Northwest Territory, the federal government, because it is a creature of the states, couldn't say, we own that land. They were holding it in trust, and it was designed out. The reason why they plotted it out into townships with acreage, it was so that people could lay individual claims to property. People, not governments.
That's right.
So roll forward to 1958, the Alaska Statehood Act. But in that interim period from 1785, which is when the Seven Ranges Survey was done, we had up in 1803, so it didn't take them long. Less than 20 years, Charles.
That's
then
it.
They were all of a sudden, they were like, well, wait a minute. We need to have some of that land.
Yeah, it's 14 years.
14 years, that's
in
right.
In 14 years, the federal government was already...
18 years.
18.
Yeah, so 1785 was the Seven Ranges Survey.
Right, right. So, well, yes, but the federal government basically came into existence under the Constitution
in 1789.
In
89, so you knock off 4 years... So it's 14 years.
It's 14
right.
years. It took 14 years for the federal government to basically decide to steal land from the states.
Right. And Chuck, what is their constitutional defense for that? What's their constitutional holding that they can take that land? Oh, wait a minute. We just read it, didn't we? It's in Article 1.
That's right.
For forts, dockyards, arsenals, magazines,
and other needful buildings.
Chuck, I mean, I've seen some pretty big governmental buildings,
yes.
usually in Washington, D.C., but I don't think we see ones that take up 5 million acres. I don't think we see ones that take up 116 million acres. What we do see is national parks and national wildlife refuges.
National monuments.
National heritage areas or world heritage areas.
That's the problem, and we need to get into that because... there's some things going on down in Texas with the Alamo that kind of touch on this, but these World Heritage Areas.
Yes.
If you go to Philadelphia and go to the Independence Hall and the Liberty Bell, those are World Heritage Areas. They're
mm-hmm.
they're under the administration of the National Park Service, but they're really owned by the United Nations. Now, that may sound paranoid to you, but that's exactly what has happened. Actual control has been handed over to the United Nations, and they're held in trust now. They're operated in trust by the National Park Service.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem in my book, because the UN is an illegitimate entity. It has no authority, no power, and yet they act like they have authority and power, and they act like they have it because the federal government allows them to act like they have it. Okay, that being the case, we've now seen the case of the federal government has basically stolen land. If you go to states like Nevada,
mm-hmm. right.
I think Nevada is essentially, I'm trying to remember the exact number, 87 or 88% owned by the federal government. Why? Sure, it's a big desert, and a lot of people may not want to own a lot of that property. But there's a lot of other stuff that's very... livable, very nice, that you can't get at because it's a, quote, national monument. And Utah, name a state, Arizona, New Mexico, any number of the western states, Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, Colorado, Texas.
Okay, Nevada, 84.5% federally owned.
Essentially 85%.
Yeah, California, 45.3%. Utah, 57.4%. It goes on and on.
There is no reason for the United States government to own those lands. And in fact, what should be happening constitutionally, if the state legislatures want the property back, and that's the question here, does the state government want the property back? Well, they're foolish if they don't want it back.
Now, which state would you guess the federal government owns the most as a percentage of the state land area?
Alaska.
Exactly. 69.1% of Alaska is quote unquote owned, and I'm using that in quotes because they don't.
Held in trust.
Held by the federal government. To compare that, Ohio, which by the way would fit inside Alaska a number of times,
many, many times,
1.7% of our total land mass is held by the federal government. Our neighbors to the west in Indiana, it's 2%. In Michigan, it's 10%.
That's not surprising.
Right. And the biggest holding on the entire East Coast, all the way up to the Mississippi, down the Mississippi River, of any state in the Union is in the state of Vermont, where 13.4% is held by the federal government.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, remember, that's a percentage versus total land mass, so it doesn't really take too many national parks in Vermont to make up that kind of land mass.
Well, it's interesting knowing what the history of Vermont is, how Vermont came to be. Vermont came to be...
Wait, let me make sure I'm right. Is Vermont the one that points up or points down?
Vermont is on the border with Lake Champlain between New York and
New Hampshire. That wrong. It's New Hampshire.
Okay, New Hampshire.
New Hampshire, the live free or die state, is 13.4% owned by the federal government.
Yeah.
Okay, shows you that I didn't get an A.
That's okay.
In
geography.
US geography.
Geography. Yeah. It's the first time I flew into Vermont. I was flying over. I was with a companion. Who was we were traveling on business, and I said, "What is that body of water?" He goes, "That's Lake Champlain." And I'm like, "Oh, of course it is. Duh." Yeah. So much for my geography grades. So you see the problem. Why does the federal government even own 1.7% of Ohio's land? It's certainly not for Dockyards magazines. What dockyards would you have in Ohio anyway? Forts. And other needful buildings. Well, one of the needful buildings I can think of is DSCC in Columbus. Okay, that's a place that they would hold for the purposes of doing distribution of construction materials and that kind of thing. How many acres does that end up being? That's maybe 50 acres or so.
What, you mean in New Hampshire?
No, I'm talking about in Columbus.
Oh, in Columbus. Well, basically, it's a grand total. The entire federal share in square miles is only 762 square miles.
That's a lot of property.
That's a lot of property. But in Alaska, it's 458,318 square miles of land.
Right.
You know, Nevada's got a higher percentage. But theirs is 93,000 square miles of land versus 458.
Yeah, and you can fit Nevada inside Alaska several times
as well. Yeah. Exactly.
So the question here is, we don't want to get off in the minutia and forget what the idea is.
But the idea is, you've got a bunch of people in Alaska who believe that the federal government have a constitutional right to this land.
There are several people who do, but there are several people who know correctly that it doesn't have a right to that land.
Yeah.
And that therein lies the question. And that is where the constitutional crisis will come from. Because what the opponents are saying is, this is going to be a loser in court. Guess what, Barry? I happen to agree with them. It will be a loser in federal court.
Yes, it will.
Because the federal courts are out of control. Now, what do I think will be the final outcome of that? Well, if Alaska has any backbone at all. They're saying, they will say, we're taking it, period. Doesn't matter what the federal court says, the federal court is wrong. It's what the Constitution says. Mm-hmm. And we are taking that land back. Now, the question I would have for you on this basis,
mm-hmm.
is there a precedent for taking land back from the federal government?
Yes, there is, as a matter of fact, and it goes all the way back to what you said earlier about 10 square miles.
That's right. It goes back to Washington, D.C.
State of Virginia.
The state of Virginia. If you'll recall, we talked about this in Article 1, Section 8, Clause mm-hmm. 17.
Yes.
That to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not to exceed 10 miles square, as made by session of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of government of the United States. Well, folks, guess what? Two states ceded land to create Washington, D.C.
Maryland and Virginia, right?
Maryland and Virginia. And that land is completely under the control of the federal government.
By the Constitution.
By the Constitution. It's... people say, well, it's no fair because they don't have congressional representation. Wrong. They have 435 congressional members. They have 435 congressmen. You and I have one. They have 435. They may not like their 435, but they got them.
That's right.
They have 100 senators. We have two. Unfortunately, they have one president and same number we have.
You were going to say, and we don't have one.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I wish we didn't, but we especially not this one, but we do.
Or maybe not the next one either.
That being said, what happened at some point, everybody will look at a map and say, yeah, but the District of Columbia stops at the Potomac River between Virginia and Maryland.
Yes, it does.
That Virginia part isn't there anymore. Oh, guess what? You're right. It's not there anymore. And you know why? Because Virginia took it back.
They reclaimed their prerogative.
They did what's called retrocession.
Retrocession. That's right.
They retroceded that portion. Now, is this completely in the same camp? No, because there was some talk at the time. The Virginia legislature says, well, if Congress okays it, we'll take it back. In other words, yeah, boo-hoo, we're not going to exercise our state sovereignty over that land fully. We're going to let the federal government tell us whether we can have the land back mm-hmm. or not. Now, it so happens that the Congress, sort of fearing a constitutional crisis, which, remember, and the date this happened was 1847, we were in between the secession crisis of the 1830s and the secession crisis of the 1860s, and basically a lot of the southern states were pounding their chest about state sovereignty. And the federal government was really kind of afraid of what might happen there, and they said, "Yeah, sure, we'll give you that. We'll cede that back." Now, let's go back to the Constitution for a minute. The primary ceder of the land,
right,
is who? It's the
state legislature.
It's the states. Who's the primary acceptor of the land?
Congress.
Now, if I give you something and you accept it with caveats
mm-hmm.
that you won't abuse it, and you begin to abuse it, I could say, okay, I want that back.
Right.
Because I gave it to you in trust.
Right.
This is a situation that it's held in trust.
Right.
The federal government does not own the District of Columbia. They are in control of it by cession of the state. This is the problem with our thinking. We believe that the federal government is a separate entity and can own things on its own. It can't. It holds them in trust for the states. Now, it holds them really because of that cession. It holds them in trust for all 50 states.
Yes, it does.
But it doesn't work that way in Alaska anymore. That land is no longer a federal territory. It's a state. They now hold that land in trust for Alaska, and Alaska is demanding it back. That's really the question here. And if we don't understand it from that basis, now why are we bringing this particular question up?
Well, you know, we want to talk about this, I want to look at this a little bit more in depth. As you know, I think we need to kind of backtrack and give a little history for those who maybe were asleep in history class. Alaska is part of the United States because in 1867, under President Andrew Johnson, William Seward made a deal with Tsarist Russia to purchase the landmass that we now know as Alaska because the Russians held it. It was purchased, I think it was $7 million.
A steal.
I hate even using those terms because that's what Russia decided they'd take for it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I'm sorry, if you have a willing buyer and a willing seller, you've got a contract.
Oh, by the way, just to hold your place there for a minute, I want to give you a trivia thing.
Okay.
Yeah, put in a marker.
All right.
I studied Russian in college.
All right.
One of my teachers, my last term, was a Russian exchange teacher. She came over from Russia to teach American students Russian. She and I had a conversation in Russian, in my broken Russian, her and her excellent Russian, about the Alaska purchase. And she made the claim that it was only a lease.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And I said, okay. And I said this in English. I've read the treaty. It was a treaty, and it was a full cession of the land. There's no lease. Yes. There's no 99-year lease. That sounds like basically drum beating for the idea that Russia can come back and take it someday.
Exactly.
So there you go. Which is why it's not a good plan for Russia or for Alaska to think in terms of secession. However, one of the things, the idea of doing this is, it's also not a good idea for the United States to make Alaska too mad.
Right.
Because it puts Alaska in the driver's seat regarding some foreign policy issues having to do with relationships with Russia, because how far is Russia separated from Alaska at its closest point?
I think the Bering Strait's less than a mile across.
No, it's about 90 miles.
Oh, okay. So where am I thinking at then? Isn't there a spot where there's a location that's a lot closer?
There is a place where there's an island.
That's what I'm thinking.
In between the two lands, and you can actually see both Alaska and Russia from. That's the old joke, you know, that Tina Fey did, making fun of Sarah Palin. I can see Russia from my house.
Yes.
Well, there are places in Alaska where you can see Russia. but that being said, this is why this is such a pivotal issue. Even peripherally. So go ahead with your. I'm sorry, I segued.
No. That's fine. That's good, though, because you helped me out. Again, remember, American geography was never my strong suit in school. So I appreciate that. We also have to remember that when the United States bought the Alaskan landmass, mm-hmm. what we call Alaska now, it was originally after the treaty had been signed and we handed $7.2 million over to Russia, that landmass was organized as the Department of Alaska, okay? And then it was renamed the District of Alaska, and then the Alaska Territory. Again, understanding that they're holding the entire land in trust. Because it wasn't Washington, D.C. who paid the bill. It was the lower 48 who paid the bill.
That's right.
Then in 1959, it entered the Union as the state of Alaska. And again, the Alaska Settlement Act of 1958, that land was supposed to be handed over to the state of Alaska. Mike Chanot and the I believe 27 members of the Alaska House of Representatives, and they've got a small, obviously, you know, there's not that many people in Alaska. The vote was 27 to 11, Chuck. So basically 38 of however many members. I'm not sure how many Alaska's House has.
I have no idea.
But 27 to 11 vote to pass House Bill 115 to basically require by December 31st, 2016, that the federal government get out, that they let go. Now, this does not include all lands, okay? They're not taking everything back, but they are taking things like Anwar back. And there's a great reason for that, Charles.
Oh, you bet there is.
When you have an administration right now in Washington, D.C., that refuses to allow there to be commercialization drilling because you've got a couple of muskox roaming around the tundra up there, and basically denying Alaskans the right to be able to, well, as other states are doing, create wealth and benefit their citizens, what you have is the federal government basically saying, no, we're not going to allow it because environmentalists mean more to us than the citizens of Alaska. And it's funny because even one of the environmentalists chipped into Lois Epstein.
Exactly.
Program director for the Wilderness Society said, I'm shocked that the House ignored the U.S. Constitution. Chuck, the amount of constitutional ignorance and illiteracy across the fruited plain is almost, it's laughable. But here's Epstein. I am shocked that the House ignored the U.S. Constitution and its legal advisors by passing this bill, unquote. Chuck, I'm sorry. Can you show me where in the U.S. Constitution that by passing this bill they ignored the U.S. Constitution? It seems to me that on the basis of this bill, they are upholding the finest tradition of the United States Constitution.
Yeah, we had this discussion in our Constitution class 3 weeks ago.
Right.
Two, 3 weeks ago, because we talked about Article 1, Section 8, and we talked about Clause 17, and we talked about national parks.
Yes, we did.
Because we have some people who are involved in the Park Service. Now, they're involved locally. They're involved in Columbus Metro Parks. But nonetheless, they understand the issue, at least from that perspective. And we said, okay, show us the constitutional authority to create a national park.
It's not in there.
It's not in there, folks. That means
there
that
is none.
We talked about Yellowstone because Yellowstone was the first national park,
mm-hmm.
and it was created in 1873. Ulysses S. Grant, if I recall correctly, signed the. Signed the document, the law that created the national park, and one of the things a lot of people don't know is that Yellowstone is a volcano.
I take that back. It's 1872. I always miss 72. That by a year.
It's okay.
I always miss that. By
it's okay.
A year.
It's okay. Really. What it goes to show is that these usurpations of constitutional authority from the states has been going on at least back to 1872. And we know they've been going back further, as we just illustrated. It goes back to at least 1803.
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Okay. The idea that somehow, because there's a precedent, then therefore the constitutional authority is there, is nonsense. You can't create constitutional authority and cut it from whole cloth and create it abracadabra with a precedent. That's not how the Constitution works. It is an express powers document. And what that means is an express powers document means that the powers specifically were given. And the reason we know it's an express powers document is because of the 10th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And the 10th Amendment basically says all the powers not specifically delegated to the federal government are retained by the states or the people, respectively. It's not a direct quote. It's a paraphrase. No point in me direct quoting it. You can look it up for yourself. That's what it says.
The 10th Amendment?
Yeah.
Yeah, the power is not specifically enumerated in this Constitution to the federal government.
That's right.
Nor prohibited by it, the Constitution, to the states, are reserved to the states and to, respectively, or to the people.
Now, the reason I brought that up is because we've already talked about the federal courts and how this will be a loser. Well, guess what, Barry? That means the federal courts will not be applying the 10th Amendment.
Well, of course they won't.
Because as far as they're concerned, John Marshall really dismantled that power in, I think, 1825. By basically saying, because the Constitution doesn't say expressly reserved to the Congress and expressly reserved to the states and to the people respectively, because the word expressly is missing, then that really is just a truism. It's just really doesn't have any legal standing. So basically what happened was is that John Marshall ruled, and he wasn't by himself, but John Marshall wrote the opinion that basically said the Constitution is unconstitutional. And we've seen that accelerated in this day and age. But what we have here is a situation where Alaska is saying, not so fast. We really don't care what the federal courts say. Because remember, Barry, there's an old saying that when you let someone be the arbiter of their own power, the final arbiter of their own power, they're going to find in their own favor every time.
Of course.
And that is what happens with the federal government. When they want to march it forward, they can do so because they know the federal courts are going to find in their favor. And they know that the states are going to say, well, we have Article 6, the Supremacy Clause, which says, and it doesn't say this, but which says that anything that they do, they have supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
No, what it says is they have supremacy where the powers are specifically enumerated to them.
That's exactly right. And nowhere in the Constitution is there anywhere specifically enumerated the power to create national parks. It doesn't exist.
That's right.
The only landmass that can be created by the Constitution, by the Congress, has already been created. It's called the District of Columbia.
Now, where does this take us?
Well, it takes us somewhere, but here's the other point I want to bring out of this article. Because most of our listeners are familiar with a region of Alaska by the name of Wasilla.
Wasilla,
because of one of their most famous residents, Sarah Palin.
And
well, Sarah Palin, call your office, because the person you've got representing you at home in Wasilla is constitutionally ignorant. Because Wasilla Republican Representative Wes Keller, quoted in this article, said that national parks are one example of a legitimate federal interest. But other land should be given to the state. And he says, well, we have a lot of federal national interest in our lands, and we acknowledge that in our national parks. That's a given. No, it's not.
No, it isn't.
It absolutely is not.
The national parks should, on demand, be immediately ceded to the states that contain them.
That's right. Now, it's interesting, though, because in Speaker Chenault's bill, the national parks were not part of the demand. They figure, okay, fine, you want to keep the national parks, you go right ahead.
Yeah.
But what we want is ANWR. We want the Izembek National Wildlife Refuge. And we want a number of other sessions of area that the federal government, including the federal Department of the Interior, have been keeping and holding out of the grasp of Alaska. They refused. Remember, they still owe Alaska 5 million acres of land from the 58 Act. They won't allow certain parcels to be part of what Alaska can take, including ANWR.
ANWR, yeah.
That's what this is about, Chuck. This is about economic development. This is about Alaska having economic independence.
Exactly.
And that's part of the reason why the federal courts will not find in their favor. Now, point is, Utah did this in 2014. They passed a bill to require the cession of federal land holdings in the state of Utah. Nothing's happened. Well, it's still early in 2015, and perhaps if Alaska, Nevada, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, if a bunch of other states start passing these same bills and then start acting as a coalition, possibly refusing to submit certain revenues to the federal government while they still hold
that's right.
lands that value X amount of dollars to the state, my guess is they'll see something happen.
Right. And we,
and as we said, as I said last night in, or the other night in class, you're not going to see the federal government roll tanks and troops into Anchorage. Because, just as you mentioned earlier, it's only 90 miles to Russia from the Bering Strait. That would be considered not a neutral act by the Russians or the Chinese.
That's right.
To have military forces, a vast influx of military forces coming into Alaska. You could ignite some seriously international incidents.
I can see the Russian media now, troops massing in Alaska. Well, what would that do? That would immediately send up alerts and give basically a revitalized Vladimir Putin an excuse to mass troops in northern Siberia there. Mm-hmm. Where the approach is closest with Alaska, because, folks, let's not kid ourselves. They're as paranoid about us as we are about them. You know, we have this kind of strange idea that, well, we're nice guys and nobody should ever be paranoid about us. I hate to tell you this, our nice guy image is long since tarnished. There are people sitting around looking for ways to use what the U.S. does as an excuse to do certain things. And Putin would welcome the ability to rally the troops, so to speak, and revitalize the Russian military and set up a situation where it creates a, let's face it, it creates a dangerous world situation. We're at peace there. It's just a mess. Now, what's the bottom line on all this? I think the bottom line on all this is this shows what the real issue is, and that is state sovereignty. Barry, one of the things, and we talked about knee-jerking at the beginning
That's
of
right.
the show, and I want to go into we've only got a few minutes left, but I want to talk about where the knee-jerks are. The knee-jerk is the idea that the only remedy that we have left to fix our country is a constitutional convention. And if you want to play the game, the semantics game, a convention of states,
right.
Which supposedly exists in Article 5. Ladies and gentlemen, I invite you to pick up a copy of the Constitution and peruse it. Article 5 is about three long sentences long, maybe five. You tell me where you find convention of states in that particular.
I'll tell you what, Chuck. I'll go one better. If they'll send us their information, we will send them a copy of a con. We'll give them a.
We'll give them a copy
of a constitution.
Yeah, we'll give them the informed juryman.
Send us your name and mailing address and contact information, and we will send you a free copy of the Constitution of the United States.
That's right.
And you can. And if you find in there and you mark it up and you send it back to us, then we will acknowledge that.
Yeah. So basically what I'm saying is, no, the state legislators taking back their authority is what the real solution is here. And let me tell you something. The advocates for a convention of states hate that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, as I pointed out last week in our show where I dissected Mark Levin's interview with Glenn Beck, they speak out of both sides of their mouth on the issue. On one hand, they're talking about how awful it would be if the states were to begin to nullify federal legislation, and that's exactly what we're talking about here. And on the other hand, they say that the states have to step in and take control and rein in agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of the Interior, blah, 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 down the line. You can't have it both ways, Barry. You
no,
cannot.
You can't.
Either the states are sovereign,
or they're not,
and they can do these kinds of things, or they're not. And a new constitutional convention isn't going to get you any place.
Well, we're going to discuss that in much greater detail in our next segment or our next program, because we're going to be talking about some of the complete fallacies that are being put forth right now, including threats of primaries against people who are speaking out in legislatures against the COS
movement.
Yeah,
opponents of a convention of states who understand the extreme danger of calling a new constitutional convention are being targeted by people who call themselves conservative. Well, that's it for this week. We're out of time. Please join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.